Thank you all very much. Can you all hear me? Okay. I'm a little disorganized because I've been traveling for several days. I'm not the best organized person in the world anyway. And I tend to leave things in hotel rooms. Ties and socks, shirts. ties and socks and shirts I leave in hotel rooms. Sometimes shoes. In this present case, I left behind me something I planned to read tonight. Because it was announced as a reading. And my friend Quincy has some relatives in town, and they came along with a couple of substitutes. So I'm going to read a couple of things, three things, in fact, sort of with no comment, one thing from Mountain, and one short thing from just above my head, and a short address I made more than 20 years ago in Michigan, which I will read with no comment. If you have trouble hearing me, please let me know. This is from Go Tell It on the Mountain, the beginning of the conversion, John's conversion. I think that things probably happened for the best. I was listening to the music, which is where I come from. Mother Smith and her daughters and her family. And it's very instructive to be forced to recognize from time to time that you make many, many voyages and go many, many places. In fact, you never leave where you began. And where you began, where you were nourished, is always, if you trust it, there. It is always, in some sense, available to you. It is your life blood, really. It's your bread and water. And it gets you from one day to the next, through various midnight hours. And I've not been around as long as Mother Smith, but she made me feel as though I might consider doing that. This is John. In the grave where he now wandered, he knew it was the grave. It was so cold and silent, and it moved an icy mist. He found his mother and his father, his mother dressed in scarlet, his father dressed in white. They did not see him. They looked backward over their shoulders at a cloud of witnesses. And there was his Aunt Florence, gold and silver flashing on her fingers, brazen earrings dangling from her ears. And there was another woman whom he took to be the wife of his father's, called Deborah, who had, as he had once believed, so much to tell him. But she alone, of all that company, looked at him and signified that there was no speech in the grave. He was a stranger there. They did not see him pass. They did not know what he was looking for. They could not help him search. He wanted to find Elisha, who knew perhaps who would help him. But Elisha was not there. There was Roy. Roy also might have helped him, but he had been stabbed with a knife and lay now brown and silent at his father's feet. Then there began to flood John's soul the waters of despair. Love is as strong as death, as deep as the grave. But love, which had perhaps, like a benevolent monarch, swelled the population of his neighboring kingdom, death, had not himself descended. They owed him no allegiance here. Here there was no speech or language, and there was no love. No one to say, "You are beautiful, John." No one to forgive him, no matter what his sin. No one to heal him and lift him up. No one. Father and mother looked backward. Roy was bloody. Elisha was not here. Then the darkness began to murmur, a terrible sound, and John's ears trembled. In this murmur that filled the grave, like a thousand wings beating on the air, He recognized the sound that he had always heard. He began, for terror, to weep and moan, and the sound was swallowed up and yet was magnified by the echoes that filled the darkness. This sound had filled John's life, so it now seemed, from the moment he had first drawn breath. He had heard it everywhere, in prayers and in daily speech, and wherever the saints were gathered, and in the unbelieving streets. It was in his father's anger, and in his mother's calm insistence, and in the vehement mockery of his aunt. It had rung so oddly in Roy's voice this afternoon, and when Elisha played the piano, it was there. It was in the beat and jangle of Sister McCandless's tambourine. It was in the very cadence of her testimony, and invested that testimony with a matchless, unimpeachable authority. Yes, he had heard it all his life. But it was only now that his ears were opened to the sound that came from darkness, that could only come from darkness, that yet bore such sure witness to the glory of the light. And now, in his moaning, and so far from any help, he heard it in himself. It rose from his bleeding, his cracked, open heart. It was a sound of rage and weeping which filled the grave. Rage and weeping from time set free, but bound now in eternity. Rage that had no language, weeping with no voice, which yet spoke now to John's startled soul of boundless melancholy, of the bitterest patience and the longest night, of the deepest water, the strongest chains, the most cruel lash, of humility most wretched, the dungeon most absolute, of love's bed defiled, and birth dishonored, and most bloody, unspeakable, sudden death. Yes, the darkness hummed with murder. The body in the water, the body in the fire, the body on the tree. John looked down the line of these armies of darkness, army upon army, and his soul whispered, "Who are these? Who are they?" And wondered, "Where shall I go?" There was no answer. There was no help or healing in the grave, no answer in the darkness, no speech from all that company. They looked backward, and John looked back, seeing no deliverance. Thank you. This comes many years later. Can you still hear me? All right. The end of just above my head. Jimmy is now 35 years old. Arthur is 39. And Jimmy and Arthur have indeed spent 14 years together. I agree that this does not seem possible, but with or without our agreement, time passes just like that. Boy, you sure took me for one big ride. He had sung that as an encore on the Paris Music Hall stage for Jimmy, who had not been there. He had played his own piano. He had not, after all, been bad, not as far, in any case, as his audience had been able to hear. He had been drunk, stoned, in a state of fury and anguish and panic, and had certainly not, as far as he had heard himself, been good. He had been certain that Jimmy was ashamed of him and should have been ashamed of him, and that that was the reason that Jimmy had not been there. Yet the people, that void beyond him, roared. He was imprisoned, blinded by the light, and had completely lost the sense of humor which had been his key to, "Boy, don't get too lost in all I say." He'd always handled it as a funky light blues ballad. Now, last night, he couldn't handle it at all, managing to get through it without entirely losing the beat, that is to say, the meaning, standing up and bowing and getting the fuck off that stage, pouring out salt water, a flood of salt water, from his eyes and his prick in the toilet. But at the time, I really felt that way. Now he does not know what he feels, and a tremendous weight seems to gather in his chest and between his shoulder blades. He wonders what I, his brother Hall, what I think of him really. He wonders if Paul, his father, is dead in the grave because he was ashamed of his son. And at the very same moment that he knows better, he also knows that he does not know, he will never be released from the judgment or the terror in his own eyes. For he knows that it is he and only he who so relentlessly demands the judgment, assembles the paraphernalia of the judgment day, selects the judges, demands that the trumpet sound. He wants to state his case and be released from the judgment. But he can be released from the judgment only by dropping the case. Lord knows I've got to stop believing in all your lies. But anguish is real and has massive consequences. It is true that our judgment flatters the world's indifference and makes of us accomplices to our doom. But to apprehend this and change it demands a larger apprehension of our song. For in fact, at this moment in Arthur's life, Jimmy has packed his bags in the Paris Hotel, has wearily, sternly dried his weeping eyes, has called the desk to wake him in the morning to have a cab ready to take him to the airport, where he will take the plane for London. He regrets the lover's quarrel of the night before, but now intends immediately to get back to his lover and travel with him to New York. And the book he opens after he's poured himself a drink and stretched it on the bed is not Lamentations. He's a little worried, true, but one is always worried by the conundrum of the space to be conquered in order to be joined with the conundrum of one's lover. He has not the remotest thought of judgment, judges, or trumpets. In fact, to tell the truth, Jimmy simply misses Arthur and wants Arthur in his arms, gets a mild heart on, shifts his weight in bed, still reading. He's reading as one always does at such moments, something by Agatha Christie, and will have got to the end of it before realizing that he has read it before. Jimmy claims that he has read in his life exactly one Agatha Christie novel, but that he's read it about 87 times. And Ruth and I are waiting for them in New York, Ruth deciding what to feed them, Julia, who will do the actual shopping, writing down his decisions as Ruth delivers them over the phone. I just want to get some sleep before the two voyaging monsters come in, because I certainly won't get much sleep once they have come in. And the kids, more accurately Tony, Odessa is too young, wondering what their uncles will have brought them. Arthur leans on the bar. He has begun to be aware that others in the pub are aware of him. He is aware that is suddenly of his notoriety, of himself as a famous singer, standing drinking alone in some obscure London pub. In fact, it may or may not be obscure. He doesn't know. He simply wandered in there some time ago. He walked from Piccadilly, and now he knows where he is. He's not far from his hotel. He has a moment of panic as he straightens, for he has one of the bad habits of a star, or at least a star so beleaguered and improbable, which is to wander about with no identification and no cash. Both delicately and courageously, he plunges into his pea jacket, relieved to discover his wallet, passport, traveler's checks, and the Lord alone knows how, some English pounds. The fact of the English pounds is due entirely, he realizes, to Jimmy, and he smiles as he takes the £5 note out of his wallet. He is aware of the unsmiling Irish eyes in the far corner of the room. He is aware of the other eyes on him, and he wants to get away from here, suddenly away from these people, these eyes, this death. And then again, something hits him, lightly in the chest and between his shoulder blades. He leans lightly on the bar, holding onto his £5 note. He thinks that it must be gas, indigestion. He will go to the toilet as soon as he pays his bill. He pays his bill, but his hands are shaking. He puts his change in his pockets just any old way and crosses the room. The toilet is at the far end of the room, through a narrow door, and down a flight of steps. The journey across the room is the longest journey he has ever forced himself to make. He starts down the steps, and the steps rise up, striking him in the chest again, pounding between his shoulder blades, throwing him down on his back, staring down at him from the ceiling just above his head. I had a dream the other night. Jimmy and Julia and Arthur and me were standing on a country porch. It was raining, but we were sheltered from the rain. It fell before us like a curtain. We could see outside this curtain, but nobody could see us. It was as though we had all been sitting in the house, talking, or playing cards, or playing music. And someone had said, "Oh, children, come look here, look over yonder." And so in my dream, Julia, who has been sitting in the house, writing a poem, puts a poem in the belt at her waist, a heavy belt. I remember it from somewhere, but I don't have time to ask her anything. And Jimmy, who has been cutting off his hair with some big, cruel, golden scissors, and Arthur, who has been sort of weaving the hair as it falls to the floor into something he wants to give Jimmy and me, I, Hall, who seems to have been chopping wood so that we can have a fire tonight, all go running to the porch. I have the feeling that it might have been Paul's voice, but it might have been Ruth's voice. She is somewhere in this dream, either holding my elbow a little bit behind me or talking to Florence. But Florence is in the rain, pouring down on the road, just beyond this country porch. She is the only person I see, and I see her because of the mother-of-pearl comb in her hair, which calls the rain, flashing on the comb like lightning flashes, or the pillar of cloud by day. Amy is helping her to hold up Martha, and just behind her, Sidney and Joel are trying to help each other up the blinding road. I hold Tony on my shoulders. His hands cling to my hair. Odessa clings to my knees. Ruth's fingers stroke my back. Arthur moves to stand beside me. Shall we tell them what's up the road? From the torrent of the road, Florence gives a warning, exasperated look. Oh ho, oh ho. Florence, Paul flashes the magic silver locket my brother gave to me and is covered by the rain. Oh ho, oh ho. I turn and look at Arthur. We hear the rain just beyond us. The rain pours down. Brother, I'm going away to leave you. Oh ho, oh ho. Let's go inside, says Jimmy. Oh ho, oh ho. And everyone is laughing. I have made a fire. We have fed the children, and the children are in bed. We are all drenched from the rain, even though I don't remember that we ever left the porch. The fire begins to dry us at the same time that it makes us know how wet we are. And Arthur repeats his question. Shall we tell them what's up the road? The question torments me like a song I once heard Arthur sing and can't now in my dream for the life of me remember. I wish, says Jimmy, busy with the brilliant scissors at Arthur's rainforest of Senegalese hair, while Arthur's fingers are busy with whatever garment it is that he is weaving for Jimmy, that you just let the rain do whatever the rain is doing. Oh ho, oh ho, says Julia. Hurry down, sunshine. See what tomorrow brings. I never heard Arthur sing this song. He turns his head and watches me. The sun went down. Tomorrow brought us rain. Then I do remember in my dream the beginning of a song I used to love to hear Arthur sing. Oh, my loving brother, when the world's on fire, don't you want God's bosom to be your pillow? And I say to him in my dream, no, they'll find out what's up the road, and nothing up the road but us, man. And then I wake up, and my pillow is wet with tears. Thank you. The last thing I'll read is, well, I think you will decipher it as I go along. It was a speech I improvised in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and it would be about 22 years ago, maybe a little bit more. The interior evidence will let you know, I suppose. It's called In Search of a Majority. I'm supposed to speak this evening on the goals of American society as they involve minority rights. But what I'm really going to do is invite you to join me in a series of speculations. Some of them are dangerous, some of them painful, all of them are reckless. It seems to me that before we can begin to speak of minority rights in this country, we've got to make some attempt to isolate or to define the majority. Presumably the society in which we live is an expression, in some way, of the majority will. But it is not so easy to locate this majority. The moment one attempts to define this majority, one is faced with several conundrums. Majority is not an expression of numbers, of numerical strength, for example. You may far outnumber your opposition and not be able to impose your will on them, or even to modify the rigor with which they impose their will on you, i.e. the Negroes in South Africa, or in some counties, some sections of the American South. You may have beneath your hand all the apparatus of power, the political, military, and state, and still be unable to use these things to achieve your ends, which is the problem faced by De Gaulle in Algeria, and the problem which faced Eisenhower, when largely because of his own inaction, he was forced to send paratroopers into Little Rock. Again, the most trenchant observers of the scene in the South, those who are in battle there, feel that the Southern mobs are not an expression of the Southern majority will. Their impression is that these mobs fill, so to speak, a moral vacuum, and that the people who formed these mobs would be very happy to be released from their pain and their ignorance if someone arrived to show them the way. I would be inclined to agree with this simply from what we know of human nature. It is not my impression that people wish to become worse. They really wish to become better, but very often do not know how. Most people assume the position, in a way, of the Jews in Egypt, who really wish to get to the promised land, but were afraid of the rigors of the journey. And of course, before you embark on a journey, the terrors of whatever may overtake you on that journey live in the imagination and paralyze you. It was through Moses, according to legend, that they discovered by undertaking this journey how much they could endure. These speculations have led me a little bit ahead of myself. I suppose it can be said that there was a time in this country when an entity existed which could be called a majority, let's say a class, for the lack of a better word, which created the standards by which the country lived, or which created the standards which the country aspired. I'm referring to, or have in mind perhaps somewhat arbitrarily, the aristocracies of Virginia and New England. These are mainly of Anglo-Saxon stock, and they created what Henry James was referred to, not very much later, as our Anglo-American heritage, or Anglo-American connections. Now, at no time did these men ever form anything resembling a popular majority. Their importance was that they kept alive, and they bore witness to two elements of a man's life, which are not greatly respected among us now. One, the social forms called manners, which prevent us from rubbing too abrasively against one another. And two, the interior life, or the life of the mind. These things were important. These things were realities for them. And no matter how rough-hewn, how dark the country was then, it is important to remember that this was also the time when people sat up in log cabins studying very hard by lamplight or candlelight. That they were better educated than we are now can be proved by comparing the political speeches of that time with those of our own day. Now, what I have been trying to suggest in all this is that the only useful definition of the word majority does not refer to numbers, and it does not refer to power. It refers to influence. Someone said, and said it very accurately, that what is honored in a country is cultivated there. If we apply this touchstone to American life, we can scarcely fail to arrive at a very grim view of it. But I think we have to look grim facts in the face, because if we don't, we can never hope to change them. These vanished aristocracies, these vanished standard bearers, had several limitations, and not the least of these limitations was the fact that their standards were essentially nostalgic. They referred to a past condition. They referred to the achievements, laborious achievements of a stratified society. And what was evolving in America had nothing to do with the past. So inevitably what happened, putting it far too simply, was that the old forms gave way before the European tidal wave, gave way before the rush of Italians, Greeks, Spaniards, Irishmen, Poles, Persians, Norwegians, Swedes, Danes, wandering Jews from every nation under heaven, Turks, Armenians, Lithuanians, Japanese, Chinese, and Indians. Everybody was here suddenly in the melting pot, as we like to say, but without any intention of being melted. They were here because they had wanted to leave wherever they had been. They were here to make their lives and achieve their futures and to establish a new identity. I doubt if history has ever seen such a spectacle, such a conglomeration of hopes, fears, and desires. I suggest also that they presented a problem for the Puritan God, who had never heard of them, and whom they had never heard. Almost always as they arrived, they took their places as a minority because their influence was so slight, and because it was their necessity to make themselves over in the image of their new and unformed country. There were no longer any universally accepted forms or standards, and since all the roads to the achievement of an identity had vanished, the problem of status in American life became, and it remains today, acute. In a way, status became a kind of substitute for identity, and because money and the things money can buy is a universally accepted symbol here of status, we are often condemned as materialists. In fact, we are much closer to being metaphysical, because nobody has ever expected from things the miracles that we expect. Now, I think it will be taken for granted that the Irish, the Swedes, the Danes, etc., who came here can no longer be considered in any serious way as minorities. And the question of anti-Semitism presents too many special features to be profitably discussed here tonight. The American minorities can be placed on a kind of color wheel. For example, when we think of the American boy, we don't usually think of a Spanish, Turkish, or Greek, or Mexican type, still less of an Oriental type. We usually think of someone who is a kind of cross between the Teuton and the Celt. And I think it is interesting to consider what this image suggests. Outrageous as this image is, in most cases, it is a national self-image. It is an image which suggests hard work and good, clean fun and chastity and piety and success. It leaves out of account, of course, most of the people in the country. And most of the facts of life. And there's not much point in discussing those virtues it suggests, which are mainly honored in the breach. The point is that it has almost nothing to do with who or what an American really is. It has nothing to do with what life is. Beneath this bland, this conqueror image, a great many unadmitted despairs and confusions and anguish and unadmitted crimes and failures hide. To speak in my own person, as a member of the nation's most oppressed minority, the oldest oppressed minority, I want to suggest most seriously that before we can do very much in the way of clear thinking or clear doing as relates to the minorities in this country, we must first crack the American image and find out and deal with what it hides. We cannot discuss the state of our minorities until we first have some sense of what we are, of who we are, what our goals are, and what we take life to be. The question is not what we can now do for the hypothetical Mexican, the hypothetical Negro. The question is what we really want out of life for ourselves, what we think is real. Now, I think there's a very good reason why the Negro in this country has been treated for such a long time in such a cruel way. And some of the reasons are economic and some of them are political. We have discussed these reasons without ever coming to any kind of resolution for a very long time. Some of them are social. And these reasons are somewhat more important because they have to do with our social panic, with our fear of losing status. This really amounts sometimes to a kind of social paranoia. One cannot afford to lose status on this peculiar ladder, for the prevailing notion of American life seems to involve a kind of rung-by-rung ascension to some hideously desirable state. If this is one's concept of life, obviously one cannot afford to slip back one rung. When one slips back not a rung, but back into chaos and no longer knows who he is. And this reason, this fear, suggests to me one of the real reasons for the status of the Negro in this country. In a way, the Negro tells us where the bottom is. Because he is there, where he is, beneath us, we know where the limits are and how far we must not fall. We must not fall beneath him. We must never allow ourselves to fall that low, and I'm not trying to be cynical or sardonic. I think if one examines the myths which have proliferated in this country concerning the Negro, one discovers beneath these myths a kind of sleeping terror of some condition which we refuse to imagine. In a way, if the Negro were not here, we might be forced to deal within ourselves and our own personalities with all those vices, all those conundrums, and all those mysteries with which we have invested the Negro race. Uncle Tom is, for example, if he is called an uncle, kind of saint. He is there, he endures, he will forgive us, and that is the key to that image. But if he is not uncle, if he is merely Tom, he is a danger to everybody. He will wreak havoc on the countryside. When he is Uncle Tom, he has no sex. When he is Tom, he does. And this obviously says much more about the people who invented this myth than it does about the people who are the object of it. If you have been watching television lately, I think this is unendurably clear in the faces of those screaming people in the South, who are quite incapable of telling you what it is they are afraid of. They do not really know what it is they are afraid of, but they know that they are afraid of something, and they are so frightened that they are nearly out of their minds. And the same fear obtains on one level or another to varying degrees throughout the entire country. We would never, never allow Negroes to starve, to grow bitter, and to die in ghettos all over this country if we were not driven by some nameless fear that has nothing to do with Negroes. We would never victimize as we do children whose only crime is color and keep them, as we put it, in their place. We wouldn't drive Negroes mad as we do by accepting them in ballparks and on concert stages, but not in our homes and not in our neighborhoods and not in our churches. It is only too clear that even with the most malevolent will in the world, Negroes can never manage to achieve one-tenth of the harm we fear. No, it is everything to do with ourselves. This is one of the reasons that through all these generations we've disguised this problem in the most incredible jargon. One of the reasons we are so fond of sociological reports and research and investigational committees is because they hide something. As long as we can deal with the Negro as a kind of statistic, as something to be manipulated, something to be fled from, or something to be given something to, there is something we can avoid. And what we can avoid is what he really, really means to us. The question that still ends these discussions is an extraordinary question. Would you let your sister marry one? The question, by the way, depends on several extraordinary assumptions. First of all, it assumes, if I may say so, that I want to marry your sister. And it also assumes that if I asked your sister to marry me, she would immediately say yes. There is no reason to make either of these assumptions, which are clearly irrational. And the key to why these assumptions are held is not to be found by asking Negroes. The key to why these assumptions are held has something to do with some insecurity in the people who hold them. It is only, after all, too clear that everyone born is going to have a rather difficult time getting through his or her life. It is only too clear that people fall in love according to some principle that we have not as yet been able to define, to discover, or to isolate. And the marriage depends entirely on the two people involved. So this objection cannot hold water. It certainly is not justification for segregated schools or for ghettos or for mobs. I suggest that the role of the Negro in American life has something to do with our concept of what God is. And from my point of view, this concept is not big enough. It has got to be made much bigger than it is, because God is, after all, not anybody's toy. To be with God is really to be involved with some enormous, overwhelming desire and joy and power which you cannot control, which controls you. I conceive of my own life as a journey towards something I do not understand, which in the going toward makes me better. I conceive of God, as a means of liberation and not as a means of controlling others. Love does not begin and end the way we seem to think it does. Love is a battle. Love is a war. Love is a growing up. No one in the world, the entire world, knows more, knows Americans better, or odd as this may sound, loves them more than the American Negro. This is because he's had to watch you, outwit you, deal with you, and bear you, and sometimes even bleed and die with you ever since we got here. That is, since both of us, black and white, got here. And this is a wedding. Whether I like it or not, or whether you like it or not, we are bound together forever. We are part of each other. What is happening to every Negro in the country at any time is also happening to you. There is no way around this. I have been suggesting that these walls, these artificial walls, which have been up so long to protect us from something which we fear must come down. I think that what we really have to do is create a country in which there are no minorities, for the first time in the history of the world. The one thing that all Americans have in common is that they have no other identity apart from the identity which is being achieved on this continent. This is not the English necessity or the Chinese necessity or the French necessity, but they are born into a framework which allows them their identity. The necessity of Americans to achieve an identity is a historical and a present personal fact, and this is a connection between you and me. This brings me back in a way to where I started. I said that we couldn't talk about minorities until we had talked about majorities. And I also said the majorities had nothing to do with numbers or with power, but with influence, with moral influence. And I want to suggest this, that the majority for which everyone is seeking, which must reassess and release us from our past and deal with the present and create standards worthy of what a man may be, this majority is you. No one else can do it. The world is before you, and you need not take it or leave it as it was when you came in.